right, welcome back, everybody. We are in hour number two of a Friday backpatting edition of Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah. Thanks for joining us today. 888-660-9535 is the number to get in touch with us. This is Tony Beam. I'm the Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders for the church and society. I also serve as the Director of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. My co-host for today and next week is Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, informed and unafraid.
All righty. While we're waiting for Josh Kimbrell to call in, let me talk a little bit about some of the things that happened in the legislature this past week. By the way, the Baptist Courier finished up my article for them yesterday. It will be coming out, it'll be a couple of weeks because it's actually the May edition. So there's probably going to be a lot of things happen between now and then. But it looks like medical marijuana it didn't make the crossover date. So I don't think that it's going to pass in this half of the legislative season. You know, the way South Carolina works is kind of strange. This is year one in a 2-year cycle. So what that means is everything that's happening now will come back up again in January if it's still out there. I mean, if you've got bills that are floating around that either made one past one house or the other, they can be brought back up in January. And a good example of that is the Save Women's Sports. By the way, Alabama passed a bill, their legislature. House and Senate passed a Save Women's Sports bill yesterday. That's expected to be signed by the governor, so Alabama becomes another state that says to the NCAA, we're not going to let you dictate our values to the people of Alabama. We're going to protect our values here. And I'm hoping that South Carolina will do the same thing in January. It's not going to happen this year because the first Save Women's Sports bill was tabled in the House Judiciary. So it's not going to – we don't have time to get another bill through. But we did, thanks to John McCravey, Representative John McCravey, his subcommittee, which is the Special Laws Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee of the House, along with Ashley Trantham, was able to refile the Save Women's Sports bill. Minor changes, really doesn't change any of the effect of the bill. It passed in the subcommittee and is now back in the judiciary for a second opportunity. I don't think anything's going to happen to it. It's possible the judiciary could pass it to the House floor, but if they do, it's probably not going to be debated until January. But what we're hoping is we'll have that bill kind of teed up like the heartbeat bill was, and we'll be able to get it out, get it passed in January. A lot of things can happen between now and then, but I guess it's like they say, sometimes in the legislative process, you don't get everything you want. So you've got medical marijuana, you've got Save Women's Sports, you've got the open carry bill, which has passed the House and is now in the Senate. We don't know where that's going to go. It's in the committee process right now. And then, of course, the hate crimes bill passed the House, still with the SOGI language, that is the protections for transgender and sexual orientation in the language. It's now in the subcommittee process in the Senate. There are several senators who have said that if they can't get that language out of there, that they're going to block the bill from passing. Here's the thing. Conservative states that have passed hate crimes legislation have stayed with the constitutionally protected language that is generally accepted for things like hate crimes. They haven't expanded to include sexual orientation and transgender. And so South Carolina wants to be one of those states. We don't want to be one of the states that includes that language. We are a red state. I think the values that we have is not to expand, but to go with the traditional language for race, national origin, age, and sex. I think those are the main categories. All right, South Carolina Senator Josh Kimbrell is on the phone. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Tony. Good to be with you. Sorry I'm a minute late getting here.
It's, that's all right.
Always fun when you have a signal dead zone.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's that happens in South Carolina from time to time. Well, what we like to do on Friday mornings is just give you an opportunity to kind of start off by talking about this last week in the South Carolina legislature, particularly the Senate. What did you see being accomplished, and what are your hopes for the rest of the session?
Well, I think on the big ticket items that people care about, we had conversations this week within our caucus, and
Josh, Senator, we lost you. Yeah, we've lost him. That's a complete drop call right there. We'll just have to see if we can get him back, because I'd really like to hear what he says. He was actually about to talk about the caucus meetings, and that's for those of you who don't know. You have a Democratic caucus, you have the Republican caucus, so they get together and they meet and they work out strategy and they talk about what bills are going to rise to the surface, what bills are going to be left for the next session. They sort of work out exactly how they're going to work out the rest of the year. So I'm interested to hear from Senator Kimbrell if he's willing to we'll see how much he's willing to tell us about what's happening in the caucus meetings. Okay. Senator Josh Kimbrell is back on the phone. You were about to talk about the caucus, I think.
I don't know.
We're not going to be able to do it. The cell phone signal is just not strong enough for us to be able to keep a conversation going. Caucus meetings are where the strategy is worked out and where you get everybody kind of lined up to determine, what bills you're going to try to pass, what is the likelihood of the bills passing. I wrote extensively in the Courier this month that will come out, like I said, toward the end of this month, about medical marijuana, because I think obviously that's going to be extended over the summer into the fall and then into January session. I hope to be able to organize some pastors' meetings over the summer and to get some representatives from the medical community and from SLED to come and give testimony to pastors. I think we've been asleep on this. I just think when I talk to people about it, they don't want it. I mean, yeah.
If you also, I have a big, long write-up. A couple of years ago when we first started the show, I did a two-hour show. I did the whole 2 hours talking about medical marijuana. I spent weeks doing this research.
Right.
I've got all of this information. I've got definitions. What is medical marijuana? What is cannabis? What's the difference? All the definitions for them. What are the side effects? And it's all written up. I have all of it in notes. If anybody wants it, I will send it to you for you to have, just so you can kind of look at it and what does it mean for, to be a Schedule I substance? What are other Schedule I substance drugs? What does that mean? And what do both sides of this argument, what are they saying? How do you respond to that? So anyway, it's just a lot of information. So,
well, what you have to remember is that marijuana is an unregulated narcotic. I mean, that's what it is. Most narcotics are I'll give you an example. I take one little pill at night that helps me when I don't have a problem going to sleep. What happens is I wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock and then I can't go back to sleep. And what this little pill does is it helps me to stay asleep through the night. I mean, if I wake up, I'm able to go back to sleep rather than just laying there until it's time to get up and come to the studio. So that is, in order to get that, I have to show my ID, and they won't let me, let's say that I drop one down the sink and I want to, I run out before the end of the month. So I go to the pharmacy and I say, look, I dropped a couple of pills this month, an accident. No, you can't have them until the date that your prescription says that you should have run out. Now, why do they do that? Because they're making sure that I'm not going out on the street and selling them. Mm-hmm. Now that's just a little, it's a sleep aid for Pete's sake. And I have to use ID. We're talking about handing a non-licensed narcotic out to people and telling them that they can smoke 2 ounces every 14 days, but who's going to be the one to tell that, to monitor that, to see how much they're actually smoking or vaping, we should say, because medical marijuana has to do with vaping now. They've changed that over. Okay, Senator Kimbrell's back on the phone. Welcome, sir.
Well, I'm glad to be back with you. You mentioned dead zones earlier. I was in North Carolina, not South Carolina, this morning,
And
apparently mountains obstruct signal.
Yes. I think that's a pretty fair statement. Well, you were about to talk about the caucus, and I assume talking about some of the conversations you're having within the Republican caucus in the Senate. So that's where you were.
Well, yes. And let me be clear. Our caucus meetings are the cone of silence. I will not discuss what happened in caucus meetings because we have a gentleman's and ladies agreement on that. But I will tell you, among members of the caucus, there's a strong consensus that we got to do something on guns, and we're going to. And I said that last week when we spoke, and this week I feel like there's an emerging consensus that we need to work on the strong Second Amendment bills over from the House. I'm just going to prep everybody for the reality that will, I think, definitely it happens this session, this year. I will do it this year, but it's not going to happen until probably after the budget, because we're very deep into the budget process now with the Finance Committee. There's a lot moving on the financial side and making sure we understand where the budget numbers are going to be for the year and the surplus. So I don't want folks losing heart. I'm getting emails from some constituents and some of your listeners who are saying, oh, we're sad that the Senate's killed Second Amendment legislation this year. That isn't true. We have not killed anything. There's been no up or down vote yet. There will be. And just stay encouraged and give us time to get through the budget. But it's coming. I think that was an encouraging thing this week.
Let me ask you a question about that. Now, the House has passed open carry, which a lot of people are confused about because there's two approaches. There's open carry and there's constitutional carry. The House passed open carry, and it's over in the committee process in the Senate, right?
Yeah. So open carry is in the Judiciary Committee, as is constitutional carry. We have both. Both have been advanced by the House.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. The House passed constitutional. I thought constitutional carry was only in the Senate, hadn't passed the House yet, but it did pass the House.
The House passed both bills separately.
Okay, all right.
So both bills separately passed the House, and both of those are now over in the Judiciary Committee. Now, that's where a lot of good stuff, unfortunately, goes to die. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to argue that. We have a conservative majority in the Senate now. We have a strong conservative majority in the Senate now. The process of committees, though, is still where things get hung up, and there's going to be discussion. And I don't want to preempt anybody or put anybody on the spot here. I need to see how this plays out. There's going to be discussion that if we can't get consensus in Judiciary Committee, and I'm on Judiciary, but so is half the Senate. There's two standing committees of the Senate that we divide equal parts. So there's 46 senators. There's basically 23 senators on finance, 23 senators on judiciary. And then there's all kinds of other smaller committees we're on different ones. So I'm on judiciary, but I'm one of 23 people on judiciary. And the process is controlled largely by the chairman and the ranking members. So if the chairman doesn't assign a subcommittee to handle these bills and it doesn't come out of committee, you don't vote on it on the floor. That's the way the Senate works. Very different from the House. It's very much based on each individual senator has a lot of power. Each individual senator, particularly based on seniority, can have a serious effect on legislation and the process thereof. So there's a lot of pressure within the Republican caucus. Those of us who are Republican senators saying, look, we need the judiciary to bring these bills to the floor and give us a vote. I have been told we're going to get open carry on the floor, which I think would come out of judiciary. If that happens, we're going to work to strengthen that, amend that, make it better. But if it doesn't come out of Judiciary Committee, we're going to have to look at alternative rules in the Senate to force a vote on the floor, even if we bypass the committee process.
Okay, so open carry is the one that's likely to get a vote and to get passed. Constitutional carry, probably not this session. Do you think is that an accurate assessment?
I think it's pretty accurate, but I think there's going to be an effort, and I, you know, again, you never know how things are going to play out in the Senate. It's always like, I feel like Forrest Gump. You know, the Senate is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get, right? You just never know how these debates are going to go. And I think there's going to be a move, and I support this if this happens. I think there will be a move by some of the more conservative Second Amendment members of the Senate, and I'm one of those, to amend open carry with a permit to have open carry without a permit, which would be the same thing as constitutional carry. So we may not call it constitutional carry, and it may not be that we pass the constitutional carry bill from the House. But I think you will see an effort to take open carry with a permit and make it stronger in the sense that we move toward some version of constitutional carry using the open carry vehicle.
Okay, right. That's what I was going to – that was going to be my next question. Is there any way to merge those two so that you get a much stronger – if we're going to have just one bill, what we get is stronger. So that sounds like exactly what you're working on.
But and here's the trade-off, though, that we have to talk about as conservatives among the family here. If we do that, if we do what you just were asking about, if we do that, you won't get a gun bill this year. It'll go back to the House. So let's say that we do strengthen open carry, make it open carry with the permit, and that passes the Senate. Great. That's good. But it's too late. We're going to send it. It'll have to go to conference committee. Because what we will have done is amended the open carry bill from the House, right?
Right, right.
So you have, if you amend it, the amendments have to be concurred by the other chamber. So if we do amend open carry of the permit and send it back to the House of Representatives, you're not going to get anything until next year. So here's the trade-off. Do we strengthen open carry with a permit to make it constitutional carry? In other words, merge, as you just described it, and wait till next year to get that? Or do we pass open carry with a permit this year with no changes, because it doesn't have to go back to the House? They already passed that. And let the governor sign it and allow you to open carry this year, and then go back in January of the next year and go take a bite at the apple and try to pass constitutional carry. You know, personally, I think that's probably the better choice, but I know that there's a serious clarion call out there that folks want us to amend open carry in the Senate. I'm going to be trying to do all I can to advance the strongest pro-life or pro-Second Amendment legislation we can this year.
Right.
But I do think we have to bear in mind, if you want to get something this year, probably better not to amend it.
So hate crimes legislation, let's talk about that for a few minutes. That's also in judiciary, correct?
Yeah, it's in Judiciary Subcommittee. I'm on that subcommittee. So we had a Senate version of hate crimes, which was really even worse than the House version. Both have problems. The Senate version was a nightmare. And on the subcommittee, we never passed that out. The Senate bill in the Senate is dead. I mean, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. The subcommittee that I'm assigned to on that in Judiciary did not recommend the Senate bill to the floor or even to full committee. Now the House version has been assigned to the subcommittee on which I sit in the Judiciary over in the Senate. So we're supposed to have a meeting, I would think, probably next week to hear testimony on the House version of the hate crimes bill. But it is in Judiciary Sub, yes.
Okay. You're going to have testimony. That'll be next week, you say, testimony on the
we
House?
We have not. There's not been a scheduled meeting. We reassigned the subcommittee yesterday to handle the House version versus the Senate bill. Since, like I said, the Senate version, we've taken no action. So the House bill that passed the House is now in Judiciary Subcommittee. And we were named yesterday. They reaffirmed the members of the subcommittee that handled the Senate version will now handle the House version. And that does include me. But we have not scheduled a public meeting yet. My guess is by Tuesday we'll know when that's going to be.
Final question. Appreciate your time this morning. Medical marijuana, is that what is the status of that bill right now in the Senate?
Well, medical marijuana is definitely not going to pass this year. I mean, it will not become law this year because there's not enough time. We're way past crossover, so it's not going to go. It's not going over to the Senate. That's just not going
to
happen.
Over
to the House, it's
right.
not going to happen. We're beyond that point. So I think that I don't even know that we're going to have a debate in the Senate. There's been a push for that. I know that Senator Davis wants to have a discussion with the Senate floor, and he may very well get a discussion. Right now, there's an objection on the bill, which is basically the same thing as a filibuster. It would require a special order slot setting 26 out of 46 votes to debate that bill. It's possible that we allow, the Senate allows for a debate. In other words, the objection comes off for a one-day debate and then goes right back on. But I have had enough conversations with colleagues of mine who are concerned about this issue and what it could potentially mean for recreational use. And right now, there is just no way there's 26 votes to end debate. So even if there's a debate on the floor, the objections would immediately be put back on the bill. So I doubt very seriously we even have a vote on medical marijuana in the Senate this year, much less the House. So this year, we're not going to have medical marijuana, period.
Okay.
What that looks like next year, we'll have to reevaluate.
Yeah, for me, well, I'm going to commit myself to working hard in what we would call the off-season to convince South Carolina that this is not something that we need. that we don't need to follow the example of states like Colorado, which end up legalizing marijuana and then facing all kinds of consequences by doing that. Senator Kimbrell, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your time. Look forward to our conversations every Friday. God bless you, and do me a favor. Tell Lilia hello and the boys for me as well.
I will tell them, and thank you for all you do. It's good to be with you all, as always, and have a good weekend.
There's a big column today at National Review that would be good for you to take some time to go read. It's by David Harsanyi. And basically, it is irrefutable evidence that the Afghanistan-Russian bounty story was completely false. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but just to give you a little bit of background, both Dan McLaughlin and Michael Brendan Doherty have already weighed in on the media's embarrassing Russian bounties story. In June, the New York Times reported that United States intelligence officials have concluded that a Russian military intelligence unit secretly offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing coalition forces in Afghanistan. Now, if you think back, you'll remember there was a lot of hysteria over that immediately. And, of course, it was all directed at President Trump. Well, now that President Trump is gone and we have a new president, Joe Biden, and he needs to garner public support for Afghanistan troop withdrawal to the point that he's going to bring everybody home. So then NBC News comes out and says, remember those Russian bounties for dead U.S. troops? Biden administration says the CIA intel is not conclusive. Now, let me just explain that to you. That means it never happened. The sources, when the news media put that story out, they didn't check sources. They simply, the way things worked during the Trump administration while Trump was president is if they had an inside source in the White House, and they had several. I mean, there were people in the White House, in the CIA, in the FBI, in every government agency that hated Trump, that hated the people that voted for Trump and wanted to see him defeated. And so they would gladly just send propaganda, a lot of times just things that completely unverified, to sources in the news media. The sources, the news media sources, in the old days, they would check, double check, triple check a source, make sure the story's true, and then go to press. During the Trump administration, they just went straight to press. In fact, you would have the pearl-clutching announcers at CNN and MSNBC talking about this as if it were fact, when it was essentially nothing but unverified rumors coming from an unsubstantiated source that had an agenda. And now we know that the bounty story, the Russian bounty story, was false. And why is that coming out now? Again, because Joe Biden needs a different narrative, a different atmosphere for his decision to bring troops home from Afghanistan. And so the media, a lot of the mainstream media, which has become pretty much the public relations platform for progressives, is supporting that narrative and withdrawing the previous narrative that was designed to hurt President Trump.
I think this article by Dan McLaughlin at National Review, his opening paragraph here: one of the enduring legacies of the Trump years is how sharply it winnowed the list of media organizations, media figures, and government institutions who could be trusted as sources of information. And I think that right there is going to be the legacy of the Trump administration, should be one of the legacies of the Trump administration, because he really did that. In addition to that, it also pulled the veil back on the Democrat Party and what their true motivations really are. And I know that we've talked about that kind of in regard to the Democrat Party before, and the veil being pulled away a bit in the last few years, but it really did just the media, some of these government agencies and other aspects of that he just went through, media figures that just really exposed themselves. Yeah. And they couldn't help it. They couldn't stop themselves because of their hatred for Donald Trump. And many of us would be wise, and we should, you know, no matter what you believe, about Donald Trump, you should be thankful for that, because you don't need any of these agencies lying to you one way or the other.
Well, there's, on one hand, there's, you know, we should be thankful. On the other, we should be very concerned that these agencies are not being held accountable for any of this. I mean, accountability, it's one thing to know the truth. It's another thing to act on the truth. And it seems,
and I'll throw big tech in there too, because that was one of the things that we, you know, we saw there.
Oh yeah, big tech. Do you realize? I never can remember his name. Tell me the guy with Veritas.
James O'Keefe.
James O'Keefe. James O'Keefe got banned from Twitter yesterday. Why? Twitter. The reason Twitter offered was some kind of nebulous rule violation that O'Keefe is not even guilty of. They banned him because of the CNN expose. They don't like the fact that James O'Keefe is able to ferret out the bias that's at CNN, and so they banned him from Twitter. They just kicked him off. So you're talking about big tech. That's big tech censorship, not based on standards, but based on ideology.
There's also Josh Mandel, who's running for a U.S. Senate. He's a candidate from Ohio, and he just got kicked off of Facebook because he questioned why the gentleman, and forgive me, I forget his name, but the gentleman who rammed his car into the fence around Congress, or the Senate building, I'm sorry, Capitol building, excuse me, why his page got pulled off of Facebook. So he sent them a message and said, why was all of his information pulled off of Facebook so that nobody could see? And of course, you and I know the reason, and it's because he was sympathetic to Islam and other things, and it didn't perpetuate the narrative that they like, so they pulled it down so that people couldn't put it out there. Thankfully, people had screenshot it before they did that. But anyway, this candidate for U.S. Senate emailed them and asked them that question, and you know what their response was? They banned him from Facebook. They kicked him off. They froze his page for just sending them the email. And he was talking about it in an interview that I listened to this morning. That's where we're at, where you can't even ask questions anymore. And see, those of us who asked questions of COVID last year got the same thing.
And if you want to know where that is, that's China. I mean, that's pure communist China. That's the way the Chinese treat their people. We're pretty much being treated the same way. We're being treated exactly the same way by big tech, who's willing to censor people in this country while still providing services to the Chinese, knowing that they're censoring their people. So that proves that they don't have a problem with censorship and that they don't support the Second Amendment. Let me read this last paragraph to you from David Harsanyi at National Review. And because this is a great summation of what happens in many of the news outlets when a story comes out. As the story incrementally loses its impact or it starts falling apart, as many do, it will either be walked back or quietly clarified. Journalists will even pat themselves on the back for being transparent and correcting the record, never once bothering to explain how every single one of their mistakes skews in the same partisan direction. None of the pundits or reporters or editors, Sunday talk show hosts or owners of media outlets feel the need to explain how they were supposedly duped. Sources that lie to reporters aren't burned. Nope. The lesson the media learned from the Trump years, as we saw after 60 Minutes, the 60 Minutes transparent hit piece on Ron DeSantis recently, is that there are no consequences for unethical activist journalism. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly right. The consequences have to be, people have to walk away from those sources. They have to recognize that they're being lied to, and that's how they'll be eventually held accountable. So unicorns, we're giving away unicorns here on Monday to promote this program. So just stay tuned for that.
My daughter will be tuned in.
Yes.
All about them.
We don't have any unicorns. I'm just kidding.
Are you?
I thought I would. Yes.
Sorry.
Are you really?
If you are listening and you believe that we're going to be handing out unicorns.
Yes. Just in case. Need that disclaimer over there. Yeah, well, I have no idea what the magic keyboard is either. That's pretty. But
sounds fancy.
What is an iPad Air? I know Apple stuff, and I don't even know what that is.
It's that.
Okay.
And that's the keyboard.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I'm going to assume it's a super lightweight iPad.
It must. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. Mine doesn't weigh too much.
You need one of those, Tony.
Oh, I know. I'll just
give a gift, will you?
I'll steal that one. We do have some good news. Federal court issues common sense win for campus religious group at Wayne
State. Oh, I saw that earlier.
State.
This
is by Sarah Perry. It's at the Daily Signal today. Campus group students and professors who aren't interested in kowtowing to groupthink on issues concerning their own faith and constitutionally guaranteed rights have had a run of good luck lately in the federal courts. Judge Robert Cleland of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan granted partial summary judgment for the Christian group InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, finding that Wayne State University discriminated against it when it kicked it off campus for requiring its leaders to be Christian.
Pearl clutching.
Can you imagine? You've got a Christian group on campus. Yes, we'd like to have Christians be our leaders. No, I'm sorry. You've got to let atheists. You've got to have people that hate Christianity run your organization. This is insane. But this is what Wayne State University's idea of diversity means.
I think, though, that they would be very fair in that if the pro-LGBT group, student group on campus, had a bunch of people who were straight, who wanted to lead their group, they would have no problem with it. Don't you think that they would be fair in that?
I'm sure they would be. I'm sure they would uphold the highest standards of this Christian club on campus. Come on. This is just another opportunity to try to undermine a Christian witness on a college campus. But by doing this, by this judge, Robert Cleland, coming out in favor of First Amendment rights, this means that the Sixth Circuit is kind of going along with the Supreme Court in protecting constitutional freedoms within an academic context. The courts have been moving in that direction. And we talked about this. I was on the Ethics and Religious Liberty Committee's leadership call yesterday, and we were talking about the fact that the courts are preserving religious liberty. In fact, someone on the call said this, and I was kind of surprised, but then I got to thinking about it, and I understand their point, that religious liberty is flourishing right now in the United States. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, religious liberty is under attack from every corner. In fact, all of our liberties are under attack from progressives. And that's true, but then the answer is, are they making progress in curtailing religious liberty? And really, so far, I would have to say the answer's no. They're not making the progress that they thought they would because the courts are standing in their way. The courts seem to believe that the First Amendment actually has some meaning, that separation of church and state means that the state cannot dictate to the church how they carry out their worship or the expression of their deeply held religious beliefs.
The thing about this, too, that's so imperative is we've talked about this here recently as well, is the self-censorship that's going on college campuses. So not only is the progressive ideology being the only thing that's promoted, the conservative by staff, faculty, et cetera, the students are self-censoring because of them feeling so much pressure from professors and other students. And it's imperative for them to have these kinds of wins in court for them to feel like they don't have to self-censor with their religion or with their conservative ideas on the college campus. Because that's where, you know, the college campus is supposed to be the place where we bandy about our ideas and our thoughts and we have these discussions. And it should be an environment across campus, not just this little 6-foot square over here in the corner, which is what a lot of universities are, the free speech zones. Excuse me, the entire campus is a free speech zone because we live in the United States of America.
Right.
So it's really important for students, especially at an age where you're really wrestling with a lot of this kind of stuff and you're trying to stand on your own faith. You're trying to decide what you think about the issues and what does the Word of God say about the issues. It's imperative that the college campus be a place where students can wrestle with that with one another because those discussions are important.
Well, and Hannah, that's the point of these colleges doing all this.
Yeah.
Instead of making it an opportunity for them to come to their own conclusions, they want to indoctrinate these students.
They want little drones.
To come to the conclusion that only supports a progressive point of view. Here's from the article today from the Daily Signal, InterVarsity's constitution allows all students to join the group as members. Now, that's something that you're not going to hear. When you hear this story just about anywhere else, you're going to hear that this is a bigoted group of Christians that are trying to exclude people. No, this is simply InterVarsity trying to say that leadership positions are limited to those who agree with its statement of faith. That's a common sense move. In March 2017, InterVarsity submitted this constitution that they're now going by at Wayne University, not materially different from previous iterations or different than ones used at other public universities, to campus leadership at Wayne State as required. And this is when Wayne State decided that this was discriminatory and that they weren't going to allow it, even though InterVarsity allows anybody to join the club. Christianity is a distinct faith. It cannot remain distinct if it's watered down or diluted or subverted by people in leadership positions in a club that's dedicated to pushing forward the Christian worldview. You can certainly allow people to come in and have a different point of view. They can have even from the leadership, they can have those debates within the club. But the people who make the decisions, run the show, if it's going to be a Christian organization, have to be in tune with the mission of the organization. That's true. I mean, would you really hire the CEO from Pepsi to come over and run Coke if they were still going to be running Pepsi? I mean, nobody in their right mind, everybody would see that as a conflict. You may have people at Coca-Cola that drink Pepsi, but you can't have the CEO of Coca-Cola be a Pepsi guy. I mean, it just doesn't work. Same thing is true, much more so when it comes to free speech. All right, tomorrow, Spartanburg County Republican Convention is going to be virtual, and a lot of people are asking questions. Why are we having a virtual convention? Well, it's because the venue, which was High Point Academy, will only allow, I mean, this is their rules, only allow a certain number. And I'm going out on a limb here, but I believe it was 600. And there's going to be more than that we're going to want to try to come for the convention. And so they had to switch to virtual because High Point Academy said, no, you can't. We're not going to allow. I mean, it would have been a disaster to have the Spartanburg County Republican Convention and have 200 people standing out in the parking lot that can't get in. I mean, if you want to picture what that would be like. So they switched the convention over to virtual. So from 1 to 3 tomorrow, if you're a delegate to the county convention, you'll receive an email with a passcode, and then you'll be able to vote for a slate of officers. You can vote for, you know, the chairman of the Spartanburg Convention. You can vote for the committeeman. You can vote for whatever the officers are. You'll be able to vote. Now, how are you a delegate? You're not a delegate just if you decide to go. You get to be a delegate if you went to a precinct meeting. Precinct meetings, this is the way the whole system works. You go to a precinct meeting, you get elected as a delegate. Delegates get to vote. Now, at the Republican County Convention and at the state convention, you can be a guest. You can come and you can participate in the sense that you can watch and you can listen and you can be involved, but you can't. Only delegates are allowed to vote for the officers and for the delegates that will go on to the state convention, which is May 14th. I can't remember. It's a Saturday. It's whatever that. I believe it's the 15th. Yes.
Yeah, because the 8th is a Saturday.
That's
first,
right.
8th, 15th. Yep.
It'd be the 15th. So May 15th is the state convention in South Carolina for the Republican Party.
So if you're a delegate, check your email for a link and a passcode so that you
that's
can
what,
vote.
That it gives you the ability to vote. Now, there's a group that's going to be having, and they're advertising this. In fact, I've got text messages about it and emails about it. They're having an alternative or a live event at Burnsview Baptist Church tomorrow. But now that's not the Spartanburg County Republican Convention. The convention is taking place virtually. Groups that want to get together, you can do that. If you want to get a group of people together, but still, if you get a group of people together, then the people that vote are the people that get an email that you're a delegate and you get to vote. You get to put in the passcode and vote. So that's just bear all that in mind. There's just a lot. There's been a lot going on with the precinct and the in the Republican Party, the precinct meetings. Greenville had their Republican Party meeting this past week. I think it was Tuesday night this week. And Randy Page, a good friend of mine, got elected as a committeeman, executive committeeman for Greenville County. And I don't remember. I think Jennifer Black is the chairman. I don't remember the rest of the offices. But we'll try to report to you on Monday. We'll just give you a rundown of who got elected to do what for the convention at Spartanburg.
Right.
Let's see. Yeah. Okay. We're up to three times the size of previous conventions.
Wow.
And that's why.
Great news.
Yeah, it is. And look, the people participating, that's a good thing.
We're gonna have to change how we're gonna do it. So.
Victor Davis Hanson has a piece today at the Daily Signal that you may want to take a look at. The title of it is "How to Start a War." Now, this is kind of a big piece. It's a think piece. But there's a lot of good points here that he's making. But he begins, his opening statement is that war often arises from uncertainty. And, you know, when you have the Trump administration, did a lot to try to stop Russian aggression. For example, the Trump administration flooded the world with cheap oil. I mean, and they did this on purpose. You know, we became a producer nation as opposed to just a consumer nation when it comes to oil, fossil fuels. So we get all this cheap oil going out around the world, and that was to Russia's chagrin because Russia makes a lot of money off of its oil export. It pulled out from asymmetrical missile treaties. President Trump said we're not going to play with these missile treaties that were designed to give the Russians a clear advantage. They sold sophisticated arms to the Ukrainians. If you remember, during the Obama administration, they basically got mobile meals for Ukrainian soldiers to eat in the field. The Trump administration comes along and arms the Ukrainians well enough that they've been able to hold off the Russian incursions for the time that President Trump was in office. The Russians concluded by these actions that Trump might do anything, so they waited for another president before they started testing America again. And what they're doing right now is massing troops on the Ukrainian border. They're testing Joe Biden. That's what that's about. And it'll be interesting to see what the response is, because the uncertainty can breed tension that breeds war. So read Hanson's piece. It's a good one. Hope you have a good weekend.
All right. Everybody have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. B&E. That'd be bright and early.
Yeah.